Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August the 16th, 1999, and Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon is Jill Whitman's session called Known Your Watershed, number 99-1. Let's listen in.
I just want to start out with a little bit of an introduction about myself and what I want to do here today and sort of this week, and then we'll spend most of the time with some discussion about watersheds. I teach in the Geoscience Department and Environmental Studies at Pacific Lutheran University, so I'm just from the other side of the mountains near Tacoma. And I also serve the village on the Science and Technology Committee, and we have at least one other member of the Science and Technology Committee. Sitting in the back is another one who was threatening to come as well. And Jim, can you recite the mission?
Would you like me to?
Well, I had to dig through our folder to find it, but the Science and Technology Committee exists in an advisory capacity for the village to help provide information and expertise, and some of the members of the committee have a lot of expertise that they bring. They happen to be people who actually work in wastewater systems, for example. And the Science and Technology Committee also exists to help provide some sort of history for the village, because as most of you know, the staff changes in the village with some frequency, whether that's the operations staff or even the people who are here on a shorter term basis. And so the people who serve on the Science and Technology Committee, I'm a relative neophyte. There are many people who've been associated with the village for 15, 20, or 30, or 40 years, as one of our members almost made it to. And those are people who can remember some of the issues in terms of the operation of the village that have come up over and over again. And so the committee helps to sort of offer some advice and provide expertise where they can, but then the last and very important aspect of the mission is to help strengthen the educational program of the village. And you all are here, obviously, to take advantage of that. And there are many kinds of things that are offered as part of the educational activities here in the village, some of which are teaching sessions like this. There are also things like the mine hike. There are some pamphlets that have been put together to help inform people about things and so on. And so our discussion has always been, how can we help to reach out? So I said, okay, this week I'll do my best. Now, some apologies ahead of time. I am a teacher of science. I do a lot of standing up and lecturing. I have a hard time restraining myself from doing that, but I really want this week to have a lot of discussion in it as well. So I'm going to be trying to restrain myself and blend some presentation with some discussion so that we can actually hopefully answer some questions that people have, and then also to just exchange ideas about some of these different issues. Now, I actually have four different things going on this week, and this is just a way of sort of giving you an overview of today and then some of the other topics that I'm going to be touching on, ones that we all deal with in our daily lives, whether we're at Holden or elsewhere, which is, you know, where do we get our energy from, what do we do with our solid waste, where does our water come from, and what do we do with the water after we use it. And so these are issues that Holden faces on a daily basis, just like any community that we live in, and so we'll be looking at some of those issues. Today I just want to talk a little bit about watersheds in general and how human activity impacts our watersheds, and depending upon how the time goes, I may give a couple examples of some watersheds that I've had students studying in great detail around the PLU campus, and then to spend some time talking about Holden's watershed and some of the issues that Holden's watershed faces, and then kind of bringing it back to, you know, what influence can we all have on all of this. So before I move on to any of that, does anybody have any questions? I have a hard time sitting down too, so I'll
Are you going to cover all those subjects?
Not today.
Cool.
Later this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Oh, for the other topics.
We'll find out where the water's coming from there.
Later on in the week. But today we'll be looking at the whole subject of watersheds. Now, how many people have heard the term watershed before? I would assume just about everybody has. It's been a big term of jargon that's emerged in the news in the 1990s. There are actually sort of two different definitions of watershed. One is a very engineering-based definition, and the other is really sort of the general use of the term. And when we talk about watersheds, in general, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today, we're talking about something that relates to systems of drainage. And if we think about any of our river systems that we see, we know that we have some river, large or small, and it may have tributaries, branches that are feeding into it. And so when we talk about a watershed, we're talking about all of the land area that drains into that body of water. And this is kind of a cartoon drawing of what we might be seeing. If we imagine that we have a valley with ridges up the side, then there's some place along that that's a divide, and all of the water on one side will flow into one valley, and all of the water on the other side of the divide will flow into the other valley. It's a very famous divide in our nation, which divides things in an even larger sense called the Continental Divide. Everything west flows into the Pacific, everything east flows into the Atlantic. We're just looking at something on a smaller scale. So we're looking here at some river system that may have some tributaries to it, and we're looking then at all of the land area that drains into this river system, drains into one of the small tributaries, and then ultimately out into the larger river itself. One of the other things this cartoon highlights for us is that in so many of our watersheds, these areas that all have this common drainage, we also have all kinds of human activity, and we'll come back and look at some examples of the impact of those. We may have urban areas, we may have agricultural areas, we may have industrial areas, and all of those, including the animals and so on, will have an influence on the health of that watershed. Now, how many people can name the watershed that they live in? I can. Who else can name the watershed that they live in? Can you?
Yes.
You know what watershed it is?
Rice Creek Watershed District.
And is it a tributary of a much larger watershed? Anybody else be able to name their watershed?
Luther, do we live on the upper Iowa? Why would you say Mississippi?
Well, that was actually, I wanted to show by way of example, perhaps one of the largest watersheds that we see in our country, which is the Mississippi watershed. Now, the Mississippi is ultimately the river that all of this water flows out to, into the ocean, but those of you who live in one of these states live in some smaller sub-basin of that larger watershed. And really, I think it's important to know your own personal watershed. In fact, to walk that watershed and be familiar with it. And it's more important that you can actually name that smaller watershed, because that's the one that you have the real direct impact on. Ultimately, you're going to be impacting what happens in the long run down here in the whole Mississippi. So if we're looking at most of Minnesota, that does in fact drain into the Mississippi, and then you can see there are a whole lot of states where all of the drainage ends up in the Mississippi. Now, we'll be spending a bunch of our time talking about some watersheds out here in this state and looking at how those break down.
Would one of them be the Charles River watershed?
Oh, yeah. No, I have a map of the Charles River watershed. Okay, one of the things that I was asked at a meeting that I went to a number of years ago was, not only can you name the watershed that you live in, and I can name the watershed that I live in, but can you name the watershed you grew up in?
Rock River.
I don't know. I don't know what watershed it was. So that precipitated me investigating that. Yeah.
Is it, in human terms then, it's the place that you get your domestic water from?
That's the engineering definition.
Oh, I see.
But in the more general sense, it's simply the land area that drains into a certain body of water.
Okay.
Engineers talk about that place that the water supply, surface water supply, is extracted from. So we'll actually look at that here in terms of Holden Village, and then look at it in a bigger picture.
Okay.
So if we move on to this question of, you know, what watersheds have you lived in and so on, this is the state of Washington. Now, there were just two people who put up their hands for the state of Washington. This is the map that one can go to and look and see what all the watersheds are in the state of Washington. Where I want to talk about just a couple of them today. This is the Puyallup River watershed. That's actually the one that I live in. I serve on the Puyallup River Watershed Council. This map comes from a document. That's why this one's highlighted. Pacific Lutheran University actually sits in the Clover Chambers Creek watershed, and that's where we've had some of our students doing studies. And so depending upon kind of where we go with this. I may show you some examples from there. This watershed, this is where we are. And this is the Lake Chelan watershed. And so we'll come back and look at that in some detail. Those of you who live in Washington, do you know where you live?
Everett.
In Everett. Okay. So are you in the Skykomish watershed?
Well, let's see, the Skykomish, and we have the Snohomish River that flows.
And they all end in M-I-S-H, all over Washington.
Right.
And I, you know, I'd have to see a detailed map. I actually brought a state of Washington map, so we can take a look at it.
Skykomish is higher.
Okay.
In terms of on the, you know, along the road map.
Okay.
Skykomish.
We can look later on if you want to see if we can figure it out. And
yeah.
You also had your hand up? In Edmonds area. So again, we have, I think I'm afraid I can't name them all by hand, but we can look at and see. I encourage everybody to do it when you get home. If you don't know what your local watershed is, check it out. This is a great place to check it out on the web. Anybody who's got internet access, there is a whole website that the Environmental Protection Agency has where you can do what they call surf your watershed. You can click on the state you live in, and you can bring up the state, and then you can click on the location that you live in, and it'll bring up the watershed.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
So you got like 30 watersheds in Washington. Does that mean each one is a primary watershed the way that the Mississippi is, or are those sub-regions?
They're sub-regions for sort of administrative purposes.
Okay, so what's the big watershed that Washington is part of?
Well, it depends. This part of Washington, that's right, it's the Columbia River watershed. We'll come back and look at that when we talk about Holden in particular. When you get to Western Washington, there are no big watersheds because the rivers are draining. The Puyallup is draining into the ocean. The Snohomish is draining into the ocean. And so
they're all primary.
Now, those of you who live in the interior lands of the country live in great big watersheds compared to those of us who live out along the river. And then there's some people. How about Jim and Sue? Do you actually live in a watershed?
We live in a sink.
I know, I was going to say, there are a few places in the country where I'm not sure there is any outflow drainage.
It goes from Lake
Salt Lake, for example, is wrong. That's right. Although there are some surface drainages into Salt Lake, and you could claim those as your watershed. Okay, so actually, the question was asked about the Charles River watershed. And I was trying to figure out what watershed I grew up in. And I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts. So I thought, first, well, I'll click and I'll see. And this is on the EPA site. So anybody who's interested in going to it, to get to the EPA, well, I got to this through the EPA site, is just www.epa.org. .gov gets you to the Environmental Protection site. You can go and surf your watershed. So I grew up in Lexington. The problem is I grew up in this part of Lexington.
Yeah.
So I didn't grow up in the Charles River watershed after all. But
Muddy River.
Huh?
Muddy River.
No, it's the it's the Shawshene, which is part of the Merrimack. But in any event, you can get to look lots of watershed have actually formed groups to study them and to try and enhance the quality of the watershed. Charles River is one which has a very strong active council, and so they have a whole thing up on the up on the web. Now, you're in this actually then. Mm-hmm. Are you in the Charles?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're in the West Roxbury part of Boston.
That's right. So this is your watershed.
Just outside of Needham.
All right. So I encourage people to do that and check that out. So I said, it really got me started thinking, what watershed did I grow up in? And I grew up in this watershed where you'll find the larger watershed if you go onto the website, and then you can click and discover and find actually the smaller watersheds. And so that's what I did, and discovered that I grew up in that corner of Lexington. So that's where I grew up. Now, the Battle of Lexington was fought in the Shawshene watershed. Okay, so why do we even care about watersheds is really the question. And as I said, politically, they've become a very important topic of conversation as we start to think about the impact of human activity and how that human activity affects the entire environment that we live in. And this whole idea that water drains down into some common drainage, that of a river, that means that anything that we do in our watershed is going to affect the overall health of that. And we think about water as being part of a very large cycle that water is in. The surface water is just part of that. And when we take a look at this diagram, we see this whole idea of the water cycle, evaporation from the oceans and precipitation on land, that water moving back toward the oceans either as part of surface water or as part of groundwater. And really, depending upon where you live, your domestic water supply either comes from a surface water source or comes from a groundwater source. And I'm not sure.
I can't read all the words on there. The dark green right along where it touches up to the coast. The underwater.
Underground. This is gets beyond what I was going to talk about in terms of groundwater, but that we have a lens of fresh water sitting beneath our land areas, and then the salt water tends to also penetrate in under the edges of land. And depending upon how much groundwater we start extracting, then we end up contaminating wells near our coastlines. And people who live in coastal areas may have heard of that idea of saltwater intrusion. People who live in the interior don't encounter that, but one of the most interesting things is that if we start looking at fresh water on the surface of the world, it represents less than 1% of the water that the Earth has. Only about 0.5%, and actually most of that is part of groundwater rather than part of surface water. What we're going to be talking about today is surface water and human impact on that surface water.
You call groundwater aquifers, groundwater?
Aquifer is the term that's used for the supply
groundwater. That's
down in groundwater.
But that extends beyond your so-called, what you're talking about here, on the surface.
That's right. I'm going to talk primarily about surface, but in fact, when we start looking at water systems, we can't separate the two.
Watersheds don't, the aquifers cover a lot of watersheds.
They often do. That's correct. So that when we start looking at surface water drainage, that interchange between the groundwater and the surface water gets complex, and we may actually move water from one watershed to another as part of groundwater, where it may make it to the surface again through various processes. That's right. Now, one of the questions is, what do we use water for? Now, Luther brought it up in the domestic water supply. And we need to think a little bit about what we use that domestic water supply for, and we'll return to this later on in the week here in Holden. But we use it for drinking, but we use it for a whole lot of other activities as well, right, in our homes. And I think any of us could list those off. We use it for simple things like cooking, but we use it for cleaning in terms of bathing. We use it for cleaning clothes. We use it for perhaps irrigation on our lawns and so on. But that's actually only what we're sort of personally thinking about using it for. It's also, our water system supply is often used for irrigation of croplands and for sustenance of animals. And then water is also used for recreational purposes. And all of these activities that utilize water one way or another end up affecting the health of our watersheds. And unfortunately, we also often use our water systems for disposal. And the story that's always told is that by the time New Orleans extracts their fresh water out of the Mississippi and cleans it up enough to supply it to domestic water systems, it's been through 16 other domestic water systems as it moves downstream, as it moves past other municipalities. And of course, when it goes through a domestic water system, it not only gets utilized, but it goes out into some treatment facility and then is discharged back into the river system. So it's a very complex system that we're dealing with. Now, watersheds really came to the forefront politically during the Clinton Timber Summit that was held back at the beginning of his first administration, when it was trying to be a policy established to think about how we dealt with timberlands in the western part of the United States. There were some issues there as to whether we deal with them in western of the Cascades or east of the Cascades and so on, and that the western states really can't be looked at in a uniform way, but the word watershed really emerged as a political term at that point in terms of starting to think about some of these issues. And one of the things about watersheds is they bring about a huge amount of cooperation. The Charles River Watershed Group is one that's in particular a fabulous example of the cooperation between communities and political entities at the state and federal level, and individual action, all trying to look at how we can best maintain the health of a watershed. I think they're a great educational example, and we work with our students in the Environmental Studies program to use watersheds as a place to think about this interaction between what we can measure in a chemical sense, which is really what most of us hear about, and how we think about the impact of human activity, and if we look at land use and population trends and so on. The big thing is, you know, what happens to our watersheds, and we have to think about this really in a couple different ways. One is pollution, and when we're talking about pollution, we're talking about anything that adversely affects the organisms that live in that watershed, whether it's chemical, biological, or even a physical kind of change. And we look at that, and I apologize, it's not in focus up there, but in order to keep it in focus here, we look at this as a sort of how organisms are affected, because they're a good barometer of what's happening to the overall health of the water in the system and to the environments that are part of that watershed. And those of us who live in Western Washington have been brutally reminded about how human activity can affect watersheds when we've recently had species of salmon put on the endangered species list, or preliminary step toward putting them on the endangered species list. And really, the biggest impact to the salmon turns out not to have been the chemical and biological changes that have occurred, but what has happened in terms of physical changes, how we've taken away the habitat of those salmon and their ability to reproduce and create further generations. Never mind all that we've extracted of them as well. Now, when we talk about sources of pollution, we talk about two different categories of pollution. And there are sources that are specific point sources of pollution. Generally, what we mean is it's coming out of a pipe. It means we can point to the location. We can measure what's coming out of there. We can identify who's responsible for what's coming out of that pipe. And ultimately, we can control it. And that's very important, because the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972 and had dramatic impact on the health of many of our nation's waters, because we could actually identify these point sources of pollution, such as industrial sources, factories, and so on, and then establish limits and hence control them. And some of you are probably very familiar with some of the famous stories, like Lake Erie. And Lake Erie was always described as being dead by the time the Clean Water Act was passed. And now, with the control of those point sources of pollution, Lake Erie has really returned to a very healthy lake. But really, when we start thinking about our watersheds, it's the non-point sources of pollution, which are the ones that we all can start to have an effect on and hope to improve the conditions by altering some behaviors of our communities as a whole. And by non-point sources of pollution, we're really talking about everything else. Something you can't identify, you can't point to, you can't say who is responsible for that. Doesn't typically come from just one location, but comes from runoff from a whole variety of activities. And unfortunately, what that means, very difficult to measure and very difficult to control. So if we look at types of pollutants, we can say, well, gee, there's some toxic chemicals, and we can point to the factory discharging those and penalize them and hence control what they're emitting. But when we start to look at some other kinds of things, for example, plant nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, are part of our fertilizers that we apply to make things grow, plants grow. Whether we're talking about the pansies that we have in our pots on our front porch, whether we're talking about our lawns, or we're talking about the wheat fields of Eastern Washington, all those plants need those nutrients of nitrogen and phosphorus. And so we have to think about what happens if that extra nitrogen and phosphorus not taken up by plants ends up in our river systems. And I think a lot of us have had the opportunity to see, if not firsthand, photographs of what happens when you get rivers that are completely clogged up by plants that grow in abundance in the river systems because of the excess of nutrients there. And there are a lot of other things that we can look at a very personal level, as well as looking at some of the larger land practices in poor agriculture. They really get dumped on a lot, but there are some huge areas in this country that are used for various forms of agriculture, and they have large impact on the river systems that they're near. whether that is from raising crops or whether that's from raising animals. So when we start thinking about certain kinds of waste that use up oxygen in the decomposition process, human waste is, that's an example of that. When we start thinking about sewage, oxygen is needed for decomposition. That also means that when we start thinking about large herds of animals, we've got that same thing to face. And I don't really want to go on in a lot of detail on this. I'd rather show you a few examples of some of the kinds of things in the watersheds that PLU has studied, and then open that up to talking a little bit about Holden's watershed. As I mentioned, we worked in a watershed close to Pacific Lutheran University. I apologize for the quality of this overhead. But we have the Clover Creek watershed, which drains out into Puget Sound. Pacific Lutheran University is located where this red dot is. Early on in the Clover Creek's geologic history and up through the 1960s, the creek actually flowed through the campus. The Army Corps of Engineers got involved in trying to divert it to reduce flooding. So it now has another path. And for 5 years, our class went out and studied this watershed. We have more recently been studying a very small watershed that originates on Fort Lewis and flows out to Puget Sound through the old community of DuPont, which was established as a black powder and dynamite manufacturing facility in about 1910. It's now a planned development that Weyerhaeuser owns the property and is turning it into a planned housing community. And it's a great place to look at because the changes are happening right now in the activities in the watershed. Clover Creek is a much larger watershed. The Sequalchie Creek watershed is only about this large, but we were able to kind of get our hands more into it. So what I thought I would do is just show you a few slides of some of the kinds of things going on in these watersheds, and use those as examples of some of the impact. As I mentioned, there are two different watersheds that we've been looking at. Whoops, I had that all lined up when you added to it. We looked at two different watersheds, the Sequalchie Creek watershed and the Clover Creek watershed. Thanks, John. And I just have slides that show both of these. This is a very important thing that's happened in the state of Washington, actually putting signs up near these different creeks just to remind people that they're actually seeing these. And I would guess that many of you have seen similar kinds of signs near where you live, just reminding you of what these creeks are. When we go out with our students, we make a series of scientific type measurements. This is going out and measuring some of the water chemistry. These are very simple kits that are designed to be used by a wide range of people, and I would bet that many of you could actually get access to them through your local governments. They often lend them out for people to use. We also do some more complex chemical tests that involve actually bringing out and doing more sophisticated kinds of tests as well. We also have the students collecting organisms that live in the creek, because those organisms can be very good at telling us what the health of the water in the creek is, and we use various techniques. We actually, in this creek, caught some trout a couple different times. We bring some of the samples back into the lab in those jars so that students can look at them under the microscope and see them in greater detail, and some we just look at out there in the field. We also look a lot at the conditions of the creek itself and the areas surrounding the creek. And this is in the Sequalchie Creek watershed, where in an effort to develop this area, there's been a lot of removal of vegetation. And so what we see here is a creek flowing, it's actually flowing toward us in this picture, but very little of the natural vegetation around this stream. So that we don't have any shade over this stream, shade being very important for the health of many of those organisms that live there, and we end up with invasive species like this grass growing up here, which would never grow if we had shade that blocked out the light and kept those grasses from growing. And in contrast, when we get down much lower in this same creek system, we see the creek in a very natural state here, flowing with a tremendous amount of natural vegetation. Now, this is an early spring before the trees leafed out, so we actually have some light filtering down. down into this area, but later on in the season we'd end up having most of this cut in shade, and that really changes the health of the creek in a large way. We measure some of the geologic characteristics. This is measuring actually the velocity of the water here, and also enabling us to then measure what the actual volume of water that's flowing. But this is the slide that I show for some other reasons and things that are important to kind of look at when we go and see our creek systems. What we see here is the creek flowing under a road. You can see the bridge up here. You can see a very large culvert which has been put in here that the water is flowing through, so we no longer have the natural stream bed. We have that altered. And then we can see a very large pipe right here. Does anybody know what this is?
Drain.
Thanks, guys.
Storm drain.
It's the storm water drain. That's exactly right. So the water from the surface of the roads is being collected on the surface of the roads, and it all vanishes from our sight most times, right? But where does it actually end up? Very often being discharged right back into our creek system. So whatever activities are happening up there on that road, like your car, which is gradually dripping a little bit of oil, or even the natural combustion, which produces a little bit of material which falls to the roads and is washed off, that then ends up back in our creek system. We also look at some of the larger aspects of land use. This is the Clover Creek system. The creek is flowing from sort of our right to our left in this picture. You can possibly make out just the edges of two 96-inch culverts that go a mile underneath the runways of McChord Air Force Base. Now, it turns out that those culverts actually add some health to the stream, keeps it shaded, keeps the temperature cooler, doesn't let things grow in there, but it does help to keep the temperature lower, and it probably prevents some of the contamination which is on the surface from ending up in the creek because it can't penetrate through these culverts and down into the water. But we still need to keep in mind the larger land use and all the C-140s that take off and land here, and various other names of the planes which Bobby and my son and his brother know better than I do, and all the things that they do with those planes. They refuel those planes, they wash those planes, and all of that runoff either has to be collected if they're being very careful or simply ends up into the creek systems. This is Intel, which has built with great incentive from the state of Washington in the Sebalja Creek watershed. They were offered great deals tax-wise in order to build in this watershed. And then we have to start to think, look at the size of this parking lot and the number of cars that drive daily in and out of this watershed. And are we actually benefiting the overall health of the area by having this huge population that commutes in and out? Great in terms of tax revenue to the community, and perhaps some of that money can be turned back into some projects to help the health of the area. Boeing is located, one of Boeing's many plants is located in the eastern part of the Clover Creek watershed. Both this Boeing plant and the Intel plant are very new facilities, and they have to meet all sorts of regulations that plants that were built 20 years ago never would. And those large parking lots that they have very sophisticated stormwater collection systems where that stormwater actually goes into a holding pond and has a certain amount of treatment before it's released. So in fact, Boeing is probably a better neighbor than some of the industries that have been there for 20 or more years. Boeing happens to have built on the site of an old creosote plant for coating logs. So in the long run, maybe it's an improvement. There are more personal levels of influence on our creek systems. This is a gentleman who's always been very kind to let us come onto his property and do some tests and measurements of the creek at this location, but he has a very small farm where he keeps horses. And you can notice from that horse that there is no fence between that horse and the creek. One of the things that we always measure at this location is what the contamination from disease-causing organisms is. And we measure one, which is fecal coliform. We all actually have it in our insides, but we don't want to see it in particularly large concentrations, because that typically means that whatever warm-blooded organism it came from was discharging other potentially hazardous disease-causing organisms. And this horse, unfortunately, is allowed to walk right into the creek. Now, the farmer informs us that, the high fecal coliform that we measure is from the geese who come to this area. And I'm sure the geese have contributed a large amount of the fecal coliform. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that his horses are exempt from this. There is, however, a small herd of cattle upstream from this, and I think they also play a large role since they are not fenced off. There are some very simple activities. A lot of local government entities give grants to landowners such as this to improve their practices, to do things like build fences to prevent their animals from actually entering the creek. Now, that doesn't keep the runoff from entering the creek, but it keeps the animals from actually being in the creek themselves. We can not only point the finger, however, at agriculture, we can point the finger at even local homeowners. And this is near the discharge of Clover Creek, where it flows into Stillicum Lake. And Stillicum Lake is actually an old wetland that they built a dam at one end of so that they could have a larger lake so that the residents could actually have a place for recreation. And these are some pretty high-value homes in this area, and usually extremely well-kept, including very nice green lawns that extend all the way to the edge of the creek. And unfortunately, as I mentioned before, to have your lawn look like that, which I have to confess my lawn looks nothing like that, to have your lawn look like that involves a tremendous amount of fertilizer and various kinds of pesticides to keep out all the things that make it not look perfectly green, and also a lot of water, and that a lot of watering that takes place makes all of those excess pesticides and nutrients end up in the creek system. We can point the finger very locally at PLU. This happens to be the property that the university owns for the president to live in. And this is a tributary of Clover Creek right here. And you can see that unfortunately the lawns here go right down to the edge of the creek. Although there has been some effort in the past 5 or 6 years to put in some kinds of plants and vegetation next to the creek that can help as small filters. But one of the bigger problems that the president's family has actually wrestled with is that this property previously belonged to people who donated this to the university, and this was their swimming pool. Water was diverted out of the creek into this area to form a swimming pool. And during all of those years that it was actually used as a swimming pool by the Gagne family, how do you keep your swimming pool clean?
Chlorine.
You put things in it, like chlorine, in order to keep all the unwanted critters and plants out of it. And then the water flows right back out of the swimming pool through pipes and into the creek. So the current administration has been trying to figure out what they can do to not have this turn into a swamp as a pool in their backyard, but they have not been putting those chemicals in there, and they've actually been trying various species of fish who like to eat up some of those algae and unwanted critters.
Is that on the campus?
It's actually a couple miles physically from the campus. It's very close. This is on another part of Clover Creek, and this is where somebody a number of years ago decided that they wanted to raise a few trout of their own, and so they diverted some water and have trout living in here. We have lots of trout. We can imagine what happens when we feed lots of trout and they go through their lifestyle at this pond. But another thing that happens is we're sitting and holding this water here. It's not shaded, it's not flowing, it's not getting extra oxygen to support those organisms downstream as a stream normally would with some turbulence, and the temperature is actually warming up here as it's in this stream. So as any of us go out and walk our watersheds and look at our own watersheds, we can look for these kinds of examples of things. This dam was built on McCord Air Force Base because a previous commander wanted to be able to fish. Now, unfortunately, this dam is 12 feet high. So the fish that are upstream coming downstream are trapped and he can catch them, but no fish in the natural cycle that would need to migrate upstream to spawn can do that. We start to look at the communities. This is in the Sequoia Creek watershed. This is the new planned Weyerhaeuser community of DuPont. And we can start to think about the impacts of even just our sort of suburban settings like this. We have a huge amount of impervious surface here. We have the streets where the water can't percolate back down into the ground. We have the roofs of the homes. We have sidewalks. And one of the things that they did in this community was to try to mimic the old community of DuPont, which were bungalows primarily built back in the 19-teens. And they wanted these homes to be similar and to not have their garages be the thing facing the street. So they put alleys behind all these homes and built garages on the alleys. Well, those garages have to meet fire codes, so they're two-lane paved alleys. So in terms of impervious surface here, we not only have the streets and the sidewalks and the roads, but we have a whole other set of roads serving every one of these houses. And this is one of the things that we've been looking at with our students, is trying to make some measurements over time to see, as more building takes place, can we see any of the effects of the kinds of things that would normally be part of runoff that might actually percolate down into the groundwater showing up in our streams instead. Oh, and just to show what else can happen in water, so this is Pacific Avenue. Anybody who's been near PLU is familiar with Pacific Avenue. Pacific Avenue, I just show you great use of land here. All sorts of uses of going on, built right up next to the creek, which was in the foreground. This is actually taken from the other side of that picture when the creek had so much flow in it that it decided it could no longer just go under Pacific Avenue, and it went across Pacific Avenue as well. And this has to do with the kinds of things that we do when we pave over land. The water can't naturally enter the system in a gradual fashion. It enters after large rainfall events in major bursts of water, and we end up flooding across Pacific Avenue. You can imagine the impact that had on all the traffic here that couldn't go for a while. Okay, so enough of those slides. To get a little bit of light back in here, if you guys want to just tweak those, I'll turn the lights back up around here. What I wanted to do right now was just show you a little bit about the Holden watershed, and then we can talk some about the activities going on here and in your watersheds, what you think some of those consequences are. Now, what watershed are we in here?
Lake Chelan.
We're in the Lake Chelan watershed. That's exactly right. We're in the large watershed of Lake Chelan, but in fact, we can start to think of the sub-watersheds that we're in. What tributary to Lake Chelan are we in?
Railroad Creek.
That's right. So we can go and we can click on that EPA site, and it brings up State of Washington and highlights for us the watershed for Lake Chelan. It can come up looking like this. You can actually then see sort of a blow up of that. This is the lake itself. At this end of the lake, the southern end, it flows into the Columbia River. And so we're actually part of the Columbia River watershed. This is Railroad Creek, and Holden being located about halfway up Railroad Creek. We're in the Railroad Creek watershed. Somebody did ask about the Columbia River watershed. And we can see the Columbia River watershed here. It shows up as the white area. The mouth of the Columbia being here, the border between Oregon and Washington, and all of this white area being the Columbia River watershed. And we see that it is a vast number of square miles included in this watershed, and a number of different states and provinces actually in Canada as well. So this is Lake Chelan flowing into the Columbia at this point. But some of the major tributaries to the Columbia are the Snake and then the branches of the Columbia that come down through here. So anybody live in the Columbia River watershed? No Eastern Washington the answer? But we're all in the Columbia River watershed right now. Now Holden has also looked at the watershed, which is its supply of water. And that is actually from where? We'll talk more about that, those of you who come later in the week, but where does Holden derive its source of water from that we get our type? It comes from snow and runoff, huh? From Copper Basin, that's right. And so I've copied here from a topographic map. The village is located right here. We can see
and the lodges and the Chalet Loop. This is Van Railroad Creek. The tailings are these so labeled piles. This is a very interesting thing that shows up on the topographic map as well, which says the sewage disposal pond, although it wasn't this June. This is Copper Creek that flows down between the tailing piles and joins Railroad Creek. What I've highlighted here in this dashed line is basically the crest of the ridge that surrounds the Copper Creek Basin. And so all of the water collected in this basin from Copper Peak all the way around to Buckskin ends up then flowing down over the surface and into Copper Creek and ultimately down into Railroad Creek. So when we think about what happens in the small watershed, it becomes the source of water supply for Holden, because up, I can't remember what elevation exactly of the diversion, but someplace up about here, the water is actually diverted down into Holden's water supply.
That's about 600.
Above where we are now, yeah. So these are 20 foot intervals. So when we think about what activities impact the health of the water, which is diverted into Holden's water system, we think about the activities that take place in here. When we start thinking about the health of the Railroad Creek system, then we need to think about the activities that are taking place in the much larger watershed of Railroad Creek, extending from the peaks up around Lyman Lake and so on, all the way down to the mouth of Railroad Creek. So one of the things I just wanted to mention before we kind of open this up for questions and discussion is one of the things we've done with our students is really encourage them to communicate, to not only go out and gather information, but to communicate about that information that they found. And with our students, we've gathered information, we've tried to pull that information together and look, as I've said, not only at aspects of the sort of scientific measurement that we can do, but what's going on in terms of the population activity and the land use and so on, that we can then try to pull it together and say, what does this all mean? And this is really an academic exercise that we put our students through. But then the really important thing that all of us can be involved in is communicating what we know about our watersheds and what's going on. How many people here have seen a storm drain that's stenciled with a picture of a fish that says drains to creek or drains to river or drains to ocean? That's a great way of at least trying to reach out to the public and say, boy, there's some issue. Think about this. Now, I was confronted with this, and I couldn't decide what to do. I was driving out of my neighborhood, and some people who lived a couple blocks away had a very large stainless steel pot like this, and they were pouring it into the storm drain. Now, I decided that right then and there, I didn't quite know how I wanted to confront that issue with them. Since I was on my way to a baseball game, I just kept going. And one of the things that I talked about with some colleagues after that was, what should I have done? Ideally, that sign that's there next to the storm drain should deter people from doing that. But if that sign didn't deter people from doing that, then what is our next step?
So
911. Well, the problem with 911 is that they're not the agency that polices such things. So it's a tough question. So what I'd like to do at this point, I've babbled longer than I always intend to here, is to kind of open this up to some discussion and thoughts from you all about what kinds of things you know that are going on in your watersheds, whether they're things that you see as having a negative impact, or actually activities going on trying to improve the health of that watershed, and or questions about what you think we need to be concerned about here in this watershed.
Just a question, first off. The big thing in Oregon right now is the temperature of our major waterways. The water's temperature is too high for the health of the fish and stuff like that. Is the major cause of that simply the cutting down of trees and foliage or something like that? Or is there industrial stuff being working?
Well, that's a good question, and it probably depends locally what's going on in terms of land use. But certainly if you go, and as we're doing all over the West, cutting down timber, then the water that's running over the surface of the land to join the streams is heated just by contact with the ground, which is probably warmer because it no longer has any shade from the sun, which is hitting it. And certainly in our streams, that's true as well. But also just in our neighborhoods. I mean, the water that runs off our paved streets is warmer because it's heated by that pavement. I think part of your question was also getting to, is there industrial output specifically that's warmer? And certainly that is true as well. We haven't done nearly as good a job of regulating the temperature of discharge as we have the cleanliness of the discharge. So while factories may be discharging water which they have cleaned up, it is probably warmer than when they brought that water in. And then any of us who live near any place where power is being generated by any means other than hydro, so where we're actually having some form of heat which generates steam, then the process of cooling that water to generate steam again always uses water which has been discharged. And for example, in Maine, where my parents have a cottage, this is a big oil-burning power plant for central Maine, and you know, they use the ocean there to cool the water and that heating in the process where it's been used to generate steam to turn turbines.
But I guess I really can't get a handle of what it is we're going to do to lower the temperature by 5 or 8 degrees or something like that.
And I think that's going to depend very much upon what is going on in that watershed. If it's timber harvest, then maybe what we need are much larger buffers. If it's in our own yards, maybe what we do is don't pave our driveways, but have, you know, gravel driveways. If it's, what do? We try to reduce the amount of growth and development going on, and this is a great tension.
In Wisconsin, many years ago, we went through and contacted all the farmers along Kraut Stream and fenced those streams. It improved the water quality, cooled the water down because of all the agricultural runoff was filtered in that area between the fence and the stream, coming through the weeds or whatever they were growing in there. There was a tremendous improvement all the way through. The trout population expanded very, very much.
I think it's almost easier to figure out what to do in some of these agricultural areas,
yes,
than it is what to do in our suburban and urban areas. It's a real tension between what we're wanting in our communities in terms of economic development and the amenities that we want here. The activities here in Holden, aside from the remnants that we have of the mining activities and those pretty serious consequences for the watershed, we're actually probably having a much smaller impact on the temperature of the creek here, because we really don't have pavement, don't have as much impervious surface, and we have a pretty good buffer along the creek system itself.
Do you ever think that some of it is, though, just like your experience? I don't mean to say that people are so dumb that they don't know. They don't feel policed, or they don't feel like, we know we can't go above the speed limit, or you can't drink when you're driving because what's going to happen to us. But some of it is just downright stupidity, and they're just doing it. I mean, I don't know, Senator from Minnesota, what are you doing up there for the Mississippi River? And, you know, we have it coming down to us, and I mean, I know what's happening to our river just living in Iowa from all of the pesticides and herbicides. I don't even drink water anymore, you know, unless I buy it. Because
a huge portion of it is education. I think if we can educate the individual landowner, if we can reach out to the agricultural landowner, if we can provide them some incentives and some assistance to improve their practices, we can really have an impact in terms of trying to better the situation. I'm not sure that these two individuals that I saw pouring this large pot of something into the storm drain could have read what was stenciled there. So one of the efforts that's been made in some communities is to create educational literature in many languages, you know, to reach out.
Where would this stuff, if they hadn't poured it down the storm sewer, wouldn't, you know, if they poured it down like a bathtub drain or something, that wouldn't live in the same place anyway?
Well, if it goes down your domestic water disposal system, it goes to a sewage treatment facility. So, you know, I really have no idea what was in this van. I had my mother along, who I was afraid if I stopped was going to have jumped out and started really taking these people on. And we were trying to get somewhere. So I just decided I could not deal with the issue at the time, but I've really struggled with it ever since. I would like to have known what it was. It could have been chicken broth, which, you know, you could have put on your garden. If they didn't want to do that, then it probably should have gone down the sink drain. If it was oil, then there are many places to take used oil nowadays.
You wouldn't want to go down either drain if it was oil.
Correct.
But historically, we have been raised to conception that it's for water is a vast resource, and my little bit, not a very thing, is dispersed out and not affecting anything. But that's, and we have not done much to educate people otherwise.
That's right. That's right. I'll tell you though, our kids know more about it. They're really being impacted. Hang on a sec, we'll move around this way.
I know so a lot of construction of retention ponds for stormwater drain. Is that an effective way of answering some of those problems?
Maybe. I'm sort of saddened by the ones I see because they're very artificial kinds of just, you know, holding tanks for the water. And they're usually constructed in a way that they have no vegetation in them. Vegetation is actually a very natural way to clean some of that runoff. But if you build these concrete lined holding ponds, then you don't end up with that happening.
Well, the ones I'm seeing have it. They're just a big hole dug in the ground and a new development, and they have stormwater. And they grow up with grass.
And probably in the long run, they help to a certain degree.
Are you going to cover the area of some of the new concepts of various vegetations and insects for purification from the water contaminants?
Well, I wasn't going to talk about it today, and I wasn't necessarily going to talk about it on the water day, partly because I'm not a biologist, so I'm not as educated about that as I'd like to be. Is that something that you have an expertise?
No, I've just read a little bit about it. You know, it's being worked on. I have some specifics.
Now, there are some communities that have the right climate to have an extremely successful treatment of wastewater for their communities in surface ponds with a lot of vegetation.
Well, they found vegetation that can remove
our
metals out of the water.
That's right. They've been very successful with that.
And then they burn the vegetation and retrieve the metals.
Yeah. All right, it's more heads. Jonathan?
I had a comment or something about Holden itself, because one of the things I think we like when we come here is we learn things that we should take back to us, to our home communities. And one of the things, all the signs and all the restrooms about not overloading the sewage treatment system, I always thought Holden was also sending an almost opposite message in terms of groundwater. When most years we've been here, and this year, I don't know if they still do it or if it's because of the rain, they haven't, but the sprinkler system cut the grass real short, or I don't know how often it needs cutting, period. But water, it's always running off. People, Holden is an environmentally sensitive community. If watering the lawn is okay, then we go home and water the lawn.
Yeah,
so
this
if you
is...
notice that, if you...
Oh, Jim could add to this. Science and Tech discusses this annually. It's a very frustrating thing. And one of the more frustrating things about it is that water has actually been through the entire treatment system here at Holden before it's used for irrigation. And we've talked about, are there ways that we could, you're right, set some better examples for people to take home with them? Could we, for example, take the water which has been used for simple cleaning purposes, you know, hands and showers here, and put that on to use to irrigate the lawns. That's called gray water. Some of you may be in communities or know people who actually divert their gray water out to use in their lawns, for example. Most states you actually can't legally do that. So Holden is faced with having to meet all of the health regulations that exist. And it is something we wrestle with annually. We all sort of sit and grump about it. Now, on the other hand, Jim and I were talking about the fact that the Village Green isn't this year. And many of you may have noticed that. You've been here before. And there seems to be significantly less watering going on, as far as I can tell. They used to water the roads every morning.
I always wonder whether they place real wild grasses down parts of the road. You know, it tends to make roads muddier, but it also avoids some dust.
It's an interesting issue. Another comment?
I was going to ask questions about retaining bases, too. We live on a small creek in this building up above us, and we keep them from flooding us with all the runoff. They're building large retaining bases.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of curious to see.
Well, I don't know a lot about the engineering of them. We certainly all see them sprouting up all over the place right now. What I'm really intrigued by is the two that I see locally, and I always watch them. They go in often before the development really starts. The land is cleared, and then they go in, and nothing happens for a while, particularly in Western Washington, where you can't build for half the year. And they sit there. And then half the time, nothing else ever happens again on that site. Or the whole plan for the use of that site has changed. So obviously, there's been some watching of it to say it's not working the way it was designed for.
Environmentalists are coming out of the windows. Every agency in the world has been to our house.
Yeah, to talk about it. It's a difficult issue. And ideally, if you're going to build one of these, you'd like to construct it in a way that mimics a natural system. And so many of these are just sort of boxes in the ground. One was built about 5 or 6 years ago as a mitigation site in our county. And one of the things that they had to do, I mean, it's contoured much more like a natural wetland or low area would be with water, and they also had to plant vegetation, the kind of vegetation that would normally be part of a wetland, which is much more useful in terms of filtering and cleaning.
So it isn't lined?
No, it's a clay lined, but it's not lined with anything more than that. But it's not a box. I mean, it has snags in it, and it has little islands, and it's a much more gentle system. It takes up more space, but I think more effective. Other comments that people have about things that are going on locally? Yeah, Jim.
Decorah, where I live, it looks like we're going to receive a super Walmart. We already have a Walmart, but super Walmart wants to build.
I was in Decorah the summer Walmart opened. Everybody I heard was excited about it.
Well, and that's why they want to build a super Walmart, because they're making money hand over fist. So, nevertheless, there have been people that are in opposition to it. Where they want to build the super Walmart is in a floodplain. It backs right up to the Upper Iowa River. And the folks at Walmart are trying to reassure the community and I think the State Department of Natural Resources that in fact the water that will come off of their parking lot, which would be rather large, will be probably the cleanest water coming off of any street or parking lot in Decorah, because it will go through this retention basin before it somehow winds up in the river. And as far as I know, it's not lined. So my question is, this gentleman down here was mentioning metals, are and I just don't know anything about this stuff, so, what I'm guessing is going to come off the parking lot is oil and gasoline, antifreeze. Can these sorts of retention basins absorb hydrocarbons, or will those settle to the bottom and then over time percolate down into groundwater? What happens?
Well, if all of this got into groundwater is actually nature's best purification system. Mm-hmm. And when we build septic systems, for example, we're trying to mimic nature, except for certain things that don't bind.
One big thing that's going on in this country is our do-gooders want to improve the air, so they took the lead out of gasoline and added another chemical to provide oxygen. That a little bit of addition of that chemical, it's methylene chemical.
MTB.
Huh?
MTBE.
Okay, had gone in the ground and is polluting vast subterranean lungs because it cannot be cleaned out by the ground.
But actually, there are all sorts of unfortunate examples like this. But oil, I mean, ideally the oil will float rather than sink until it picks up sort of sludge and becomes heavier and balls up and sinks. But most of those facilities that are associated with large parking lots are supposed to have oil-water separators in them, an actual filter that traps that oil, which is only effective if it's actually maintained on a regular basis as well, so that you actually have to be by somebody. And that's the problem, is that they meet the regulations and they put it in to start with, but then often it's never maintained. And so you have these great designs that allow them to build because they met all those rules and regulations, but then there's no maintenance of it to assure that over time the system is actually being allowed to function properly. So, you know, that's a question that could get asked is, you know, not only what are you doing when you build it, but what's going to happen in the long run. But, you know, it's really interesting. Are there ways that we can create places for people to park that aren't just pavement? And sure there are, but most people don't want to park in them, right? You know, you step out of your car and your work shoes and your muck or something. People don't want to do that. And so we really have got ourselves in a bind sort of in terms of people's expectations versus what we might be able to put up with.
Haven't I read that it's possible to make paving for roads and parking lots of a permeable surface?
Probably. Now, there are paving stones sold, and they look like, you know, some of these concrete blocks that you have, and they have holes in them about this large, with you know, still some substantial concrete between the holes. And I've seen them in just a few places, and you could, if you're careful when you step out of your car, step on the concrete so that, you know, you're not stepping into something that may be wetter or maybe even a little muddy with time.
I guess I was thinking of porous
materials. Porous materials.
In a subtle way.
Do you know?
Yeah. They do use porous asphalt, but the water still goes down and then flows out. You don't want to get it down into below the roadway, or you start breaking the roadway up with.
Even if the roadway were, even if it were had a substantial area of rock and gravel underneath the roadway, you still couldn't just let it flow through.
Well, particularly I'm afraid in climates where you have any freezing, that forest would be a problem. So. That's interesting. Other thoughts or questions that people have? I know people are anxious to eat. The bell will ring. Thanks for coming. And thank you.